It's 8 o'clock GMT. That's 14 hours in Dhaka, 9 o'clock in Lagos, and 16 hours in Hong Kong. Hello, I'm Alex Sabin, and these are the latest BBC News headlines. South Korea has asked China to try to persuade North Korea to calm the crisis over its nuclear program. A senior South Korean diplomat began talks in Beijing in an effort to diffuse growing tensions on the Korean peninsula. Israeli security forces have shot dead five Palestinians in a series of confrontations in and around the Palestinian territories. And investigators are trying to find out why a tanker carrying highly flammable kerosene has become the second vessel to collide with the wreck of a cargo ship in the English Channel. Details in a moment.
BBC News with Jim Lee. South Korea has asked China to try to persuade North Korea to calm the crisis over its nuclear program. The South Korean news agency said the Deputy Foreign Minister, Lee Tae-sik, made the request at an opening session of talks in Beijing with his Chinese counterpart, Wang Yi. From Beijing, Rupert Wingfield-Hayes reports.
With the North Korean leadership growing increasingly bellicose and the United States refusing to make any compromise, South Korea is now searching for another way to de-escalate this growing crisis. One obvious candidate is China, and hence the South Korean Vice Foreign Minister's visit here. China supplies large quantities of food and fuel to the North Korean regime, and has the ability to put pressure on Pyongyang if it wants to. Beijing has also made it clear it is strongly opposed to North Korea obtaining nuclear weapons. But so far, the Chinese government has been extremely reluctant to put direct pressure on the North Korean regime or to criticize it openly.
China says it hopes to launch its first spacecraft carrying astronauts later this year, in a move that would make it only the third country to put people into space. Official media quoted the director of the Shanghai Aerospace Center as saying the launch would take place in the second half of this year. China has already launched spacecraft designed to accommodate people. Israeli security forces have shot dead five Palestinians in a series of confrontations in and around the Palestinian territories. The Israelis say the men were armed and planning to carry out attacks. During the night, Israeli troops briefly entered three refugee camps in the Gaza Strip. Barbara Plett reports.
The army said it entered refugee camps in the center and south of the Gaza Strip looking for suspected militants. There were heavy exchanges of fire in the Boraj camp and some injuries reported. The incursions happened hours after Israeli troops killed three teenagers armed with wire cutters and knives. The army said they'd climbed a security fence guarding a Jewish settlement in Gaza. It killed another Palestinian allegedly armed with explosives near settlements in the West Bank. And police shot dead a gunman who broke into a home near the Israeli town of Hadera. The married couple living there managed to escape.
Brazil's first left-wing president for 40 years, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, has set out his vision of a more equal society and his plans for addressing the country's severe economic problems. In an emotional speech to a huge crowd at his inauguration in Brasilia, Mr. Lula da Silva, a former trade union leader, said it was a scandal that Brazil still couldn't manage to feed its people adequately. He promised to create jobs, tackle corruption, and narrow the gap between rich and poor. You're listening to the news from the BBC in London. French investigators are to try to find out why a ship carrying 70,000 tons of highly flammable heating oil collided with the wreck of a cargo vessel, which sank in the English Channel 3 weeks ago. It's the second time that a vessel using one of the world's busiest shipping lanes has run on to the same submerged wreck. Patrick Bartlett reports.
The Turkish tanker is now at anchor off Ostend after a night in which it courted disaster. The Vicky hit the submerged hull of the Tricolor late last night, despite numerous warning buoys and patrol vessels marking the danger area. The ship, carrying 70,000 tons of kerosene, ended up stuck fast on top of the wreck. She remained there for 2 hours, until the rising tide allowed her to float free. With her 24-strong crew still on board, the Vicky sailed north to Ostend, where she'll now undergo a thorough examination by the Belgian authorities.
French troops who've been enforcing a ceasefire in Ivory Coast say a government helicopter has attacked a village in the centre of the country and killed 11 civilians. A French military spokesman described the attack as irresponsible and unacceptable. French commanders have called on the Ivorian government to explain its actions. The spokesman for the Ivorian security forces told the BBC the raid was in retaliation for a rebel attack on government forces on Tuesday. The Malaysian Prime Minister, Dr. Mahathir Mohamad, has warned neighbouring countries that they would receive what he called a bloody nose if they attacked his country. Dr. Mahathir said that he'd received reports that certain countries in the region planned to use Malaysia as a battlefield so that war would not reach their own shores. He refused to say which countries he was referring to, but the BBC correspondent in Kuala Lumpur says his remarks will be interpreted as a response to statements by the Australian Prime Minister, John Howard, who said last month he would consider preemptive strikes against militants in other countries if they were planning to attack Australia. Australian aid officials who've flown over the two remote Pacific islands hit by a cyclone on Saturday say there's evidence that some people survived. The Australians say they saw people rebuilding homes and fishing on the islands of Tikapia and Anuta, which are part of the Solomon Islands group. BBC News.
It's 15:06 GMT. You're listening to World Briefing from the BBC in London with Roger Maud. The divided island of Cyprus has been a thorn in relations between Turkey, Greece and the European Union since Turkey occupied the north of the island in 1974. But as EU membership becomes a prospect for both Cyprus and Turkey, pressure is mounting for a negotiated settlement. A United Nations plan to reunify the island has been opposed by the Turkish Cypriot leader Rauf Denktaş. But now the new Turkish leader, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, has openly criticised Mr. Denktaş and called for new thinking on Cyprus. Mr. Erdogan says the future of the island needs to be settled quickly, and his advisor, Ecemen Barış, says this is a question of common sense.
What our chairman, Mr. Erdogan, is saying is nothing new. He has been saying from the first day on that the Turkish side should continue to negotiate, should always be in favour of negotiations, and that's what he has been repeating. From the first day on, since our party was founded, we have always said on any given issue, on any given topic, common sense and logic should prevail. And common sense on the issue of Cyprus tells us that we should negotiate, we should find a permanent, peaceful solution that respects all individuals of the island equally. And if we can achieve that, why should we give that chance away?
Ecemen Barış, advisor to Recep Erdogan. As the urgency of settling the Cyprus question increases, Mr. Erdogan has said things will only get worse if there's no deal by the end of February, a deadline designed to ensure Cyprus does not enter the European Union still divided between Greek and Turkish Cypriots. Our diplomatic correspondent Barnaby Mason looks at the significance of the changed attitude in Ankara.
For years, the Greek Cypriots and many Western diplomats have said there would never be a Cyprus settlement without serious pressure on Rauf Denktaş from Turkey. Now that pressure has materialized following the election of a government in Ankara led by former Islamists. Mr. Erdogan used harsh words. Cyprus wasn't Mr. Denktaş's personal business, he said, and the policies pursued for the past 30 or 40 years could not continue. The views of Turkish Cypriots couldn't be brushed aside. That comment is a reference to a big anti-Denktaş demonstration in Nicosia last week, which was itself encouraged by the political transformation in Ankara. Many Turkish Cypriots are afraid of falling further behind the Greek Cypriots economically when Cyprus signs a treaty in April to join the European Union. There are still problems ahead. The Turkish army has supported Mr. Denktaş's hard line ever since it occupied the northern third of Cyprus in 1974 in response to a coup in Nicosia. The UN peace plan calls for the demilitarization of the island, including a sharp reduction in the number of Turkish troops from about 35,000 to a level matching Greek forces. The biggest problem in the negotiations is likely to be the return of Turkish-controlled territory to the Greek Cypriots to be more in line with their big majority population. Mr. Denktaş has described the UN proposals on territory as utter nonsense. He also maintains that the proposed constitutional arrangements modelled on the political structures of Switzerland would destroy the political equality of the Turkish Cypriot community. The outcome of the negotiations to be resumed this month will depend largely on Ankara keeping up the pressure and on how fast Mr. Denktaş's power base crumbles.
Our diplomatic correspondent Barnaby Mason. With the build-up of American troops continuing in the Gulf, Iraq has protested that the United States is determined to go to war, despite Baghdad's cooperation with UN weapons inspectors. Washington has ordered thousands more soldiers to the region. They'll join the 60,000 servicemen and women already there. President Bush insists he's not yet taken a decision on whether to launch a war against Iraq, but many experts now think a conflict is likely in mid-February. Our Middle East analyst Roger Hardy looks at how the military and diplomatic timetables are coming together.
The next steps are already laid out. In a week's time, the Chief United Nations Weapons Inspector, Hans Blix, will brief the UN Security Council. Then, in the third week of January, he'll go to Baghdad for talks with Iraqi officials to review the cooperation between them, ahead of the date that's the most crucial deadline of all, the 27th of January, when Mr. Blix will report to the Security Council on the results of 2 months of inspections. By then, American forces in the Gulf will be ready to launch a war against Iraq if President Bush orders them to. For many countries, the most crucial question now is whether, if there is military action, it will be a US war or a UN one. It's not certain that the Security Council, when it debates Mr. Blix's report, will achieve the unanimity it mustered in November when it passed Resolution 1441, warning Iraq of serious consequences if it failed to get rid of its alleged weapons of mass destruction. The issue is far from being academic. A second resolution authorizing military action would strengthen the waverers such as Germany, Turkey and Saudi Arabia. If, however, Mr. Blix's report leaves the Security Council divided, the US and Britain will have a less than impressive consensus behind them if they go to war. The men with their fingers on the trigger are George Bush and the British Prime Minister Tony Blair. But the men who will determine what sort of war they fight and with what degree of international support will be Hans Blix and Saddam Hussein.
Roger Hardy. Israel says the 5 Palestinians, whom its forces shot dead overnight, were armed and planning attacks on Jewish settlements. At least 45 Palestinians have died in the past month as the Israeli army has stepped up its operations. International campaigners for Palestinian rights have also stepped up their activities. The International Solidarity Movement is protesting against the demolition of Palestinian homes and the building of a metal barrier in the south of the Gaza Strip. The Israeli army says it's building the wall as a defense against attacks on its forces. Our correspondent James Rogers witnessed the International Solidarity Movement's latest confrontation with the Israeli army.
At the edge of the Rafah refugee camp at the southern end of the Gaza Strip, a small crowd has gathered among the rubble. They're watching a standoff between a group of about 20 demonstrators and the Israeli army. The protesters are from the International Solidarity Movement. They address the Israeli troops through a loudspeaker.
We are watching you destroying these homes and killing these innocent people.
The object of their anger is a metal fence which the Israeli army is building to protect its soldiers in the area. The Israeli army demolished houses which they say were used as firing positions by Palestinians. They have also cleared areas to build their defenses. The United Nations estimates that more than 4,000 people in Gaza have been made homeless since September 2000. I put it to one of the activists, Ellie, that the Israelis would build their fence anyway. Her answer was interrupted by a burst of gunfire designed to drive the protesters away.
Well, yeah, they will. And they have already destroyed over 500 homes in order to do so, and they will destroy many more. I'm staying in a village just down the road, which the war hasn't reached yet. And the family I'm staying with are well aware that their home is going to be demolished.
Ellie went back to join her fellow demonstrators. Despite them, the building work continued. The Israeli army is determined to complete it.
James Rogers reporting from the Gaza Strip. You're listening to the BBC in London. Coming shortly in this programme, the latest attempt by North Korean refugees to reach the south has taken them to communist Vietnam. But first, today's main news. The new Turkish leader says Turkish Cypriots must reach agreement with their Greek Cypriot neighbours on reunifying Cyprus. The Canadian government is widely expected to decriminalise possession of marijuana early this year. The Minister of Justice, Martin Couchon, says he wants to make the penalty for being caught with small amounts of marijuana roughly equivalent to a traffic fine. That worries Canadian police and customs officials in the United States, where drug laws are much stricter. The focus of their worry is the province of British Columbia, which already produces vast quantities of cannabis, mainly to be smuggled into the United States. Our correspondent Ian Gunn reports from Vancouver.
The region around Vancouver grows some of the world's most potent marijuana. In warehouses, basements, and back gardens across Canada's southwest coast, the crop known as BC Bud is a massive underground industry. Reliable figures are obviously hard to come by, but some estimates say clandestine cannabis rivals the timber industry here in economic scale. The vast majority of the illegal crop is controlled by organized crime and is destined for the United States. So the news that Canada plans to loosen its marijuana laws is getting a chilly reception in America. Canadian police, too, say it's a bad idea. Shutting down growing operations is an almost daily part of police work here. And police say cannabis cultivation will become more common and be harder to prosecute under laxer laws. But opinion polls suggest that Canadians themselves support the government's moves. Some experts say it's unlikely that changes will increase drug use or make life harder for either Canadian police or American border guards.
Ian Gunn reporting from Vancouver. As fighting continues in Ivory Coast between government forces and rebel groups, there are fears that the price of chocolate might be about to rise worldwide. Rebel troops are now advancing on the port of San Pedro, through which most of Ivory Coast's cocoa is transported on its way to international markets. Ivory Coast is the world's largest producer of cocoa. If the rebels reach San Pedro, they could cut off a vital source of revenue for the beleaguered government of President Laurent Gbagbo. Rodney Smith from our business staff reports.
The West African state of Ivory Coast is the world's biggest producer of cocoa. Its 1.3 million tons a year of exports accounts for 40% of world supply, about twice the annual exports of the next two significant producers, neighboring Ghana and Indonesia. Until last September, Ivory Coast was an island of peace and stability in strife-torn West Africa. But a failed coup 4 months ago has grown into a civil war encompassing three separate rebel groups determined to unseat the government. About half of Ivory Coast's cocoa exports pass through the port of San Pedro. French troops, which are attempting to police a broken-down ceasefire, confirm that the rebel positions may have moved closer to the port. Any threat to the flow of cocoa beans from San Pedro would swiftly affect the international confectionery market. Cocoa prices rose strongly in the month after the failed September coup attempt to peak at $2,400 a ton. Prices fell again, but the big confectionery manufacturers have warned that they will be increasing chocolate prices. The cocoa price rose $17 a ton to just $2,021 on Thursday. President Gbagbo, whose government is heavily reliant on cocoa income, has been attempting to persuade the rebel factions to discuss a new ceasefire.
Rodney Smith of our business unit. Border police in Vietnam are searching for four North Koreans who escaped from custody last week. They took refuge in Vietnam after crossing the border from China. It's believed to be the first time that North Koreans have fled into communist Vietnam, a close ally of North Korea. Claire Arthurs reports from the Vietnamese capital, Hanoi.
Police in the northern Vietnamese border province of Ha Giang say the four were taken into custody by border police on Wednesday last week. They were kept overnight in the police station. A senior official for the province's external relations department, Nguyen Duc Thuan, says the local authorities had intended to return the group across the border back into China. But a border policeman at the Thanh Tien border station, Major Tinh Hoa Thuan, says three of the four escaped as they were being moved from the police station to the provincial administration office. One woman, aged 35, remained behind and is being treated in a small local health clinic. She's believed to be suffering from exhaustion. Major Thuan says the people had no identity papers, but indicated they were from North Korea and that they were afraid to be sent back to China. The embassies of China, South and North Korea in Hanoi say they have no information about the incident.
Claire Arthurs. The health authorities in Thailand say they're to introduce an experimental program of traditional Thai massage for tired motorists. The aim is to offer motorists on long journeys a traditional massage at service stations to help relax and refresh them. It'll be tried out at a small number of stations and then extended along main routes if it proves popular. You're listening to the BBC in London. It's 1620 GMT. A reminder of today's main news. Turkey says Turkish Cypriots will have to reach agreement with the Greek Cypriot government so that a united Cyprus can join the European Union. Investigators are still trying to find out why a ship carrying thousands of tons of oil collided with the partly sunken wreck of a car carrier in the English Channel, the second time it's been hit by another vessel since it sank in December. With more on that and the rest of the British news, here's Janet Jalil.
Thanks very much. One collision might be considered a misfortune, but now a second one looks rather embarrassing for the French and British Coast Guards. They insist they've done everything possible to alert ships travelling through the English Channel to the wreck of the Tricolour, which went down in mid-December. They've put up fluorescent buoys and radar beacons and issued regular radio alerts every few minutes. But the Vicky, carrying a cargo of highly flammable oil, passed all these warning signs and ran into the wreck. Luckily, she was then freed by the tide. Fiona Verge reports.
This is the second time that a vessel using one of the busiest shipping lanes in the world has run into the wreck of the Tricolore. 2 days after she sank, the freighter Nicholas stuck fast and had to wait until high tide to be floated free. The day before, a Coast Guard aircraft had to waggle its wings to draw the wreck to the attention of a cargo vessel sailing perilously close. Between 400 and 500 ships a day use the English Channel. Despite that, Lieutenant Commander Antoine Gouly of the French Maritime Authority says he can't understand why the latest collision occurred.
There are five buoys around the ship with a light signal and a radar, one with a radar signal. Clearly, it's quite unbelievable that the ship doesn't know there is a wreck.
The accident calls maritime safety in the Channel into question. Investigators will want to know why hourly broadcast warnings by British and French Coast Guards were apparently not heeded. But shipping unions complain of a constant drive to cut crewing levels and excessive working hours for those who remain. They claim the problems thrown up by the Tricolore were accidents waiting to happen.
That report by Fiona Verge. Thousands of people in Britain are preparing for widespread flooding after days of heavy downpours across the country. Rivers have burst their banks and drivers are being warned that their cars could be swept away by the heavy rains. John Merritt lives in Cornwall in the southwest of England. He spent Wednesday night preparing for the worst.
Well, all you can do is sandbags and things around, which we've done. But our main defence, of course, everybody along here has got walls and things to protect themselves from the river. The heavy rain, the torrential rain, which they keep telling us is about to hit us, hasn't yet so far arrived, so fingers crossed.
This winter has been particularly wet, a consequence of global climate change, according to experts. Our British Affairs correspondent Rachel Ellison reports.
The forecast is rain and more rain. Britain's Environment Agency, which looks after rivers and flood barriers, has issued 140 flood warnings. Water levels have been rising over the past few days and the agency is worried about potential loss of life and ruinous damage to property. People have been told to move their families, pets and valuables to safety. Farmers are herding their livestock onto higher land. Gas and electricity supplies may need to be turned off. Neighbours are sandbagging their homes to keep floodwaters out. Because of global climate change, Britain is becoming warmer but also wetter. 2 years ago, Britain saw massive flooding, with some high streets turning into waist-high rivers of water. There's been criticism of developers for building on floodplains, which are supposed to be emergency reservoirs, not housing estates. Insurers have said they'll charge more to people who bought homes on those floodplains, homes that may have just become harder to sell.
Rachel Ellison. Two teenage girls have been shot dead in Birmingham in the West Midlands region in central England. They'd been at a party in a hairdressing salon. Two other women were also injured and were taken to hospital for treatment. A car riddled with bullet holes was found abandoned nearby. Bob Platt reports from Birmingham.
Officers arrived at the scene of the private party at a hairdresser's shop in the Aston area of the city in the early hours of this morning. They found three teenage girls suffering from gunshot wounds. Two of the girls, aged 17 and 18, died at the scene. A third was taken to hospital, where another injured girl had also been taken. Police say a considerable number of shots had been fired at the party, and a car was later found nearby with bullet holes in it. Detectives have cordoned off the area and are appealing to the local community for help in tracking down the killers.
Bob Platt. The Chief Constable of the West Midlands, Paul Scott Lee, described the killings as unprecedented during his time in the city.
It is an example of the tragedies that occur when we've got unprincipled people out there with access to firearms. Our job is to investigate this, identify exactly who it is who has been responsible for this, arrest them and put them before the courts.
That was the Chief Constable of the West Midlands, Paul Scott Lee. In Northern Ireland, the political wing of the IRA, Sinn Féin, says the next few weeks will be a critical window of opportunity to get the peace process back on track. It's 3 months since the province's power-sharing assembly was dissolved after the largest Protestant party in the province, the Ulster Unionists, walked out in protest at alleged IRA activities and direct British rule was reimposed. Sinn Féin's chief negotiator, Martin McGuinness, said all parties to the peace process would need to work together ahead of fresh assembly elections due in May.
It's going to require, I think, a collective approach over the course of the next 6 to 8 weeks, which I think are probably going to be the most critical 6 to 8 weeks that we have seen in the course of the last 30 years. And there's no doubt whatsoever that in the course of those discussions that everybody within the process is going to have to face up to what others are saying. And of course we want to listen carefully to what the unionists are saying, as we want the unionists to listen to what we are saying about our difficulties with their attitude to the peace process and their failure to promote and embrace the Good Friday Agreement. We also want to talk about the British government about their failure to fully implement the Good Friday Agreement in relation to policing and demilitarisation, human rights and equality. And of course they want to talk to us about matters of concern to them.
Sinn Féin's chief negotiator, Martin McGuinness. Republicans and unionists also remain split over the issue of decommissioning. The unionists have said that the IRA must be disbanded if a lasting resolution is to be reached. The IRA has rejected this. In a moment, we'll hear how a 23-year-old Briton is about to become the youngest person to reach the South Pole. But first, the Public Health Laboratory says that the yearly incidence of flu have fallen steadily over the past 30 years. Last year saw a record low in cases, and experts have cited a drop in smoking and a better environment for the improvements. The Nationwide Building Society, a major mortgage lender, says that house prices rose on average by 25% last year, the highest annual rise since 1989. Nationwide says it expects a more modest 10% increase this year. Now, a 23-year-old scout leader from Britain is set to break a world record in just a couple of hours' time by becoming the youngest person to walk to the South Pole. Andrew Cooney from central England began the journey of more than 1,000 kilometres over 6 weeks ago, along with five other expedition members. Orlando Teal reports.
Andrew Cooney has struggled with altitude sickness and temperatures below minus 50 degrees in his battle to reach the South Pole. The young scout leader, who is also an officer in the Territorial Army, has been taking painkillers to cope with a shoulder injury and has made the journey pulling a heavily loaded sledge. Calling his parents earlier today, Mr. Cooney said that the first thing he wants when he gets home is a hot bath and a bacon sandwich. He spent Christmas walking in freezing winds, but celebrated with a Christmas cake made by his mother. Mr. Cooney had been planning the trek for 4 years. He had been hoping to raise money for research into cancer of the esophagus, which his father contracted, but his plans failed after a sponsor withdrew at the last minute. Andrew Cooney will take the title of youngest person to reach the South Pole from a 27-year-old adventurer, Tom Avery, who completed the journey just last week.
Orlando Teal reporting. And that's the British news. Now back to you.
Thanks, Janet. Janet Jalil. And a reminder of today's main world news. The Turkish leader Recep Tayyip Erdogan has, for the first time, directly criticised the Turkish Cypriot leader Rauf Denktaş for resisting United Nations plans to reunite Cyprus. Mr. Erdogan said the policy, which had seen Cyprus split into Turkish and Greek halves for almost 3 decades, could not continue. I'm Roger Maud. You're listening to the BBC in London.